Book of Haggai, it's mentioned that Jeroboam was noted as the son of CTL by Haggai the priest. But in 1 Chronicles, the 3rd chapter, verses 17 to 19, he is called the son of Dael, the brother of Shealtiel, and grandson of Iris. And then in Luke, 3rd chapter, verse 27, he said that he's the son of Shealtiel and the grandson of Neri. So how do you rectify that?
Well, I didn't. what I read was just speculation, but the thought was that Matthias died and left his widow. She married Shealtiel, or she just went into his house and was raised. So it became known that Zerubbabel was raised by Shealtiel, his uncle. About his grandfather.
Both of you have indicated it, but I suppose it's worth repeating. It's always good to repeat some things. That the background for both of these books is Ezra 1 through 6. And so it's really mandatory reading if you want to read these two prophecies. And it's worth, I think, saying again. As far as Haggai is concerned, in the Septuagint, Psalms 138 and Psalm 46 through 49 are attributed to Haggai as well. I think that's it's always interesting to read the Psalms and other things that go with these as well. And then Zechariah, he's quoted 71 times in the New Testament. 71 times. It's incredible. He influences Messianic, the gospel writers, you know, influence about the Messiah more than any other Old Testament prophet. And I want to comment on that Zechariah and 2 Chronicles as well. The reason I believe with you that it's a different Zechariah and the Zechariah of 2 Chronicles is because in the Hebrew Bible, their last book would have been 2 Chronicles. And so that would have been the last martyr mentioned, and Jesus uses him as the last name. And that's what he's not referring to, Zechariah. I have a couple of things here that I'd like you all to maybe comment on. This is a period that we, I think, come in contact with the Samaritans for the first time as well. And you might, I don't know if you want to comment on that. And also, in Ezra, now, if you go, we talked about this in Ezekiel, but the priesthood was from 30 to 50. And you go to Numbers and you can see that. But you go to Ezra, and when they were doing this work, Haggai and Zechariah encouraged them to do. Now all of a sudden, the age is 20 to 50. And I don't know if you want to comment on that or not. But, and then that last, you don't want to comment on it. Both nodding your head, so I don't know. From what I've read, I'll just say something about it. And from what I've read, it looks to me like there weren't very many priests, and they lowered the age. That's from what I've read. I don't know if you guys had anything on it or not. But, and then these fasts, I think the reason the Lord didn't approve of these fasts is they weren't from the heart, too. Not necessarily because they were the fast of men, but I think he saw that they, in all these prophecies, he's trying to get to their heart. The prophets were showing that the thing missing all the way through all 17 prophets is the heart. That was the main problem, and God wanted their heart. But anyway, what about the last prophecy of Zechariah? When do you think that dated? That was dated.
I'm actually unsure of the date. I do remember that he was really prophesying about keeping and making sure Israel was maintained pure, and that all the heathen practices that had been associated with some of the people in the lands around about them not affect them anymore.
Well, Well, some things I read, and I just wanted to know if you could comment on it. Some people say it's as late as 480. So that would have been, see, another 40 years after his first vision. But anyway, if you want to comment on the Samaritans or any of those other things.
Reggie? Since there was no response on Samaritans or the Eliezer priest, I'd like to respond to both of them, to the best of my ability. One of the Samaritans, I think one thing that's interesting to note there, that they were mixed breed. They were, on one hand, holding to the worship of Baal. On the other hand, wanted to hold to worship of Jehovah. And I think that's kind of indicative today, because you have the denominationalism. They want to bring a lot of worldly practices in. They didn't just say, well, we believe in God, too. And they basically said, well, since we worship Jehovah, like you worship Jehovah, let us help you build this temple. And of course, the response was, well, you don't have any, a lot of part in this matter. And basically, that's the response to the church today. You know, they say, well, listen, you know, we're all trying to serve the same God. We're all trying to get the same place. So why can't we work together? And the response to that, obviously, is you're not doing it the correct way. So you have no part in this vile matter. And of course, that created a great deal of animosity between the two groups that carried down through the centuries. And I think some of the references call about animosity, even today, between denominationalism and the church. In reference to the early age of the priest, I think part of the problem there was you had 24 priestly orders that were in captivity. And when the first call was made to them to come back to rebuild the temple, none of them responded. Eventually, as the plea continued to go out, only four of the 24 orders responded and came back to build the temple. So as you stated, I believe it was because of the shortage in the priesthood that it came about the little piece.
Now concerning the book of Haggai, when you were talking about the desire of the nations, your conclusion was that it was the choice or the elect coming into the church?
Yeah.
Okay. Isaiah teaches basically the same thing in chapter 60 when he talks about the wealth of the nations coming to Jerusalem. And I think Isaiah chapter 60 is a prophetic look at the coming of the church. And you know, the wealth of a nation, when we talk about it in that sense, it will always be its people. And I think what it indicates, obviously, is the wealth of a soul. You know, you're talking about people coming to the church, people coming to the Lord, and thus this would be the wealth of a nation. We talk about gold or silver or precious commodities, but the wealth of any nation, even today, spiritually speaking, would be the people. Now, on the book of Zechariah, you may feel free to comment on this. Zechariah chapter 6, verses 12 and 13, the prophecy of when Joshua was taken and a crown was placed upon his head, and then it says, this man will be a priest and will sit and reign on his throne. We are a very fortunate people because we live on this side of the cross. Many of these things that we're reading are clear to us because they've been fulfilled. But obviously for those people to whom they were given, they would be very difficult and they might not understand it. But I really think this is one of the most amazing little prophecies in the Bible. And we don't think about that much. I think this is a prophecy of the coming of the Messiah. But notice, I think there are two really important things that are taught here. We may not see it initially, but if you think about it, it teaches, number one, the ending of the old law, and it teaches, number two, the reign of the Messiah on David's throne from heaven. Now you look at this one individual here who's a priest, and it says, put this crown upon him. The day will come when he will be a priest, but he will also sit and reign on the throne. So you've got a combination of offices now in one person. Now, according to 2 Samuel chapter 7, the line of David, the kingship, is going to have to come from the tribe of Judah. Now, the priesthood under the law came from Levi. So we have a problem if this continues under the old law. The way that you answer this, the way you understand this, and I know the Jews probably couldn't see it. Of course, we can today. But this is going to necessitate a change in the priesthood. It's going to have to change in the law as well. But the priesthood will have to change too, because it won't be from Levi. So it also teaches the reign of the Messiah on David's throne from heaven rather than a physical reign upon earth. Because in the book of Hebrews, we're told that Christ is our high priest who sat down on the right hand of God in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 1. Whenever the Messiah reigns as priest, he's also going to reign as king. And if he's reigning as priest from heaven, then he'll have to reign as king from heaven also. So that necessitates a change of the throne of David from a physical throne over a physical people to a spiritual reign from heaven.
I appreciate that. I agree. That's one of the things I was alluding to when I found out Zerubbabel and Joshua both coming in as far as their part in to mesh the type or the shadow of the Messiah.
Jerry Davis.
Mark or anybody, I'd like to hear some comment about Zechariah 14. You know, this is a favorite text of premillennialists. Of course, it talks about Jesus. It talks about the Lord coming and setting feet on the Mount of Olives. Of course, they say that's Jesus. He'll come back literally. And the mountains will split in two, and there'll be this great battle. And down in the latter part of the chapter, it talks about all the nations will have to go to Jerusalem and worship. And of course, this is one of their favorite texts. You know, I'd like to hear some comment about that.
I think the first thing is that, you know, the breakout that I see in chapter 14 is really verses 3 through 7, you're talking about the Lord's people being delivered. And in verses 8 through 11, you really get to the point of the salvation that's available for all. And then in verses 12 through 15, the destruction of the enemies of the Lord's people. And verse 16 through 21, obviously Jerusalem was to be the place of holiness. So I guess I don't quite see, I know they used that as an argument, but I don't see that as being the topic at all of chapter 14, because I think those are the key points that are emphasized through those verses.
So you're saying this was going to be fulfilled when Jesus came spiritually fulfilled, and they're making it literal.
Right.
Other questions?
He's over here also. So.
Jimmy Dunn.
Sometimes when I discuss things with people, I don't know if this is helpful or not, but I argue from the clear back. And so sometimes if I don't understand the passage fully myself, I know that it will not contradict a clear passage, and I'll try to use it that way. And I just want to say something that it's probably obvious to everyone, but sometimes I think it's good we say the obvious. But these Samaritans, they were the worst of the worst that the Babylonians did not take off. They remained in the land. The Assyrians had sent other people into the land, and they intermarried. And they were these half-breeds who had intermarried. And so they had Jewish blood in them, but they weren't pure breed, you might say. And so they would always be, as was indicated, thorn in the Jew's side and vice versa, I suppose.
Ron Porter.
I don't want to overdo the Samaritans. They sound like they're pretty mixed up. But, you know, this has been referred to a number of times, so I thought I'd just read a couple of verses about the Samaritans, and it shows us a little something about where this religious mix came from. We all know about the marriage of different Jews. This is very interesting. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there, that's talking about the people that was imported, that they feared not the Lord, therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Wherefore they spake to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations which thou hast removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of the God of the land. Therefore he hath sent lions among them, and behold, they slay them, because they know not the manner of the God of the land. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, carry thither one of the priests whom ye brought from thence, and let them go and dwell there, and let him teach them the manner of the God of the land. Then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Howbeit, every nation made God of their own, and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation their cities wherein they dwell. This is an interesting passage, because, you know, we see this dilemma with the Samaritans coming on down through the time of Jesus. And what makes it interesting is because here's a group of people who had some knowledge of the one true God. Because the priest who came, they brought back, knew the one true God. So that's where they got that knowledge, but then it was corrupted with all their idols. And this is why I think when you have the animosity that arises in Ezra and so forth, they wanted to come up and unite, they really had a plea, because they said, we believe in the one true God. Now, where I found this passage interesting in my own life is this. You know, for many, many years, we used Old Testament passages against various innovations, etc. And they really troubled me for a long time, whether it was proper to take these verses that so often dealt with idolatry and apply them, you see, to these innovations. This passage was very helpful to me, if I understand it, because here I could see people who believed in the one true God, but they added these other religious beliefs, and that was improper. And that's one of the reasons why I felt I could then use some of these scriptures to apply to some of these various things. I'll just share that with you.
John 4.
Yeah. When he said to the woman, you worship in ignorance, he basically was saying, worshiping in ignorance is you're not worshiping according to the revelation that God has given. That's what ignorance is.
Origin.